The story of building an e-cigarette brand in the UK via China and selling it for 60 million sterling with Sam Marks, episode number 84. Let's go.
Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Happy Tuesday morning, everybody. I'm heading to Shanghai this week for about 6 days, working some deals with the Unchained Apps company and specifically the Chinese learning app WCC Dictionary. I got a lot of meetings lined up with Chinese learning centers and exciting to work some BD business development magic. I'll be back down in South China for the next show, so don't worry. And this show, actually today's interview, is a little bit of a motivator for me to get things done and make some bigger deals. But before we get into that, I also just recently made, at the request of some listeners, a quick checklist for what you need to know and get things done with setting up a company in Hong Kong. It's a simple one-page thing you can print out and motivate yourself to get things done. If you want to check it out, download it at globalfromasia.com/HK checklist, HK for Hong Kong. So this week, we're in for a treat. I mentioned that I'm a contributor for Forbes China, and I do interviews with successful business people doing business in or around China. And one of them was this amazing interview with Sam Marks, an American entrepreneur, marketer, and all-around hustler. He was introduced to me by Chris Gormley, who we've had on the show a few times here, and I thank him a lot for making that connection. So today's interview, we're going to go through Sam's journey of starting up an e-cigarette brand, SkySig, in the UK, finding his distributor in China, getting deals done, and selling for 60 million British sterling. He holds nothing back, and this one is an interview I'm sure you're going to listen to at least twice and motivate yourself to keep hustling and pushing hard. So let's get right to it. Okay, thank you all for tuning into our Forbes podcast here in China. And we have on the line with us Sam Marks, who has had a great exit of his company SkySig for $100 million. So thank you for being on a call with us today.
Glad to be here, Mike. Thanks.
Sure. So, of course, we're going to focus on that story, but maybe you can give us a little bit of background as an entrepreneur, what you were doing before you got into SkySig.
Yeah, sure. Happy to give you a little background. So SkySig started in 2009, and prior to that, I was just kind of a budding entrepreneur in different ways. My first entrepreneurial kind of initiative was in college. I started a website called thegreekfaces.com, and this was when Facebook was at only about 12 or 15 different colleges in the U.S., and I looked at the site and said, well, this is really great, and everyone at my school is jumping on board. And why don't we do this for something that I know, which is Greek life, fraternities and sororities. So decided to kind of just emulate what Facebook was doing and then just niche it down to another level that I knew well, and that was the Greek Faces, and built that out with a developer friend of mine who came on as a partner. And we kind of developed it over the next 2 years and never really knew what we had, if it was valuable. And we didn't understand the traffic we had and the growth we had. And we didn't know how to make money with it, but it was all growing, doing great, and exciting to be kind of having something that's a social community that you're controlling. And when I was a senior in college, we ended up selling that to the guys that own college.com. And after college, I went and worked with them as kind of directing manager and in charge of marketing there. And fortunate enough that they were able to sell that business about a year after I was with them, and then started pursuing other things online, did a lot of affiliate marketing, got into that game, continuity programs, learning how to deal with big affiliate networks and little niche ones. And then after that, got involved with another startup called Booked, which was a platform for hotels and any type of really lodging or vacation rental managers to really develop and build their own business, both with a back-end CRM and a front-end optimized website. And I was with that for about 2 years, just myself and the two founders, grew that to a very substantial business, and owned a significant part of the business in stock options, and decided that I wanted to start SkySig with a couple other guys, and then walked away from Booked. And Booked actually just had a great exit last January. It was acquired by a public company called RealPage. So everything worked out very well for them. Glad I'm still very, very friends with all of them. And things worked out well with us at SkySig.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, so you've definitely gone through a lot of different entrepreneurial ventures, and maybe you can just share with some of the skills that you developed early on as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, sure. I think by and far the largest skill I developed that has helped me as an entrepreneur was learning how to market online. And that most of that came through affiliate marketing, just learning how to structure ad campaigns and work with different people that had offerings and manufacturing and brands, and learn how to make sales online. And that's such a huge part of business for anyone's business today, especially, you know, when you talk about entrepreneurs our age and even younger, it's learning how to market products across the web or mobile interfaces. So I attribute a lot of my success to that. And then on top of that, it's really just learning how to be a good project manager. And if you look at any type of startup that goes from, you know, two people in a basement to a 100-person company, the people that are in charge of that business are just going to have to learn how to be great project managers, because no matter what you're doing in the business, it's just a series of new projects that are always popping up, and someone's got to drive them. And as a startup, you can't always go out and hire someone with 20 years of experience that knows how to run that. So you're going to have to stand in that position and learn how to run it. And just learning how to run a process, bring someone in and delegate it and have them run it, I think is a very important skill set to be able to learn how to have.
Definitely, I would agree. We're definitely living in a digital world and an online world, and learning how to work with internet marketing and also project management is extremely important. Was probably also remote, right? Where was your team in-house, or was it all online, or?
Well, for almost everything that I've ever done, it's been remote. And this goes back to 2005. Now, of course, SkySig, once we grew and grew, we end up centralizing. But everything else, for the most part, you might have one or two of the founders that are under the same roof. But we grew up in kind of an outsourced world over platforms like Odesk and Elance. And it's learning how to deal with the different cultures and different time schedules and everything that goes with that. So yeah, absolutely. Learning how to work remote in a disciplined fashion and keep everyone accountable is also a very important skill set.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, yeah, I love the online world, right? We're talking over on the other side of the world to each other, you know, and people all over the world can listen to this show and learn and have teams spread out throughout the world. It's definitely an advantage, but also challenges. And if we could learn that as entrepreneurs to maximize that, is a great advantage.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, we're actually, speaking of, like you mentioned, we're 12 hours apart right now. So
yeah, it's awesome, right?
It is great.
So you briefly mentioned a little bit about how SkySig started. Maybe expand on that a little bit for us.
Sure. So we were busy at the time doing affiliate marketing, and we were learning how to sell products in the healthcare vertical online very well, very efficiently. And I was out at one of these affiliate conferences in Las Vegas at the ripe age of 23, I believe. And we were just going around meeting with different people that had brands and offers and, you know, everything you do at affiliate conferences. And we ended up having, at the time, we were doing really large volumes with different types of diet supplements. And some guy who we ended up staying in contact with came knocking on a door in Vegas, in one of the hotels in Vegas. I can't remember which one it was at the time, but came knocking on his door, and it was actually a Chinese manufacturer who had one of the most early stage e-cigarettes. And he came in, and his English was quite broken, and he was showing us his product and saying, hey, you know, can you guys sell it, basically? And we took a look at this thing, and it was, you know, it wasn't very good. It was super primitive, but we're like, wow, look at that technology we've never seen before. And if this gets good, this could really disrupt tobacco. And this was back in 2007. So way before e-cigarettes were really commercialized or popular. And so we kind of kept our finger on the pulse and watched what was going on in the industry, and not much happened for the next year. And then we saw a couple companies in the US start popping up. And what happened was, some of these companies we could tell were obviously not run very well, and kind of these one-off affiliate offers. And then we noticed a couple brands that were starting to develop. And we had a couple contacts that were in processing and fulfillment, and we tapped those to see if anyone knew what was really going on. And sure enough, some of the processors were like, hey, we know what's going on. These guys are doing huge, huge volumes. You need to take a look. And so we studied this business for a little bit, and said, you know what, this is the right time and the right opportunity. Let's take this to the next best market where there's not a lot of competition yet, and that happened to be the UK. And we said, time is right, and let's go start this in the UK.
Awesome. That's really great. At the beginning, you were talking about this Chinese manufacturer knocking on your hotel door. So I'm curious, is that like, did he seek you out, or was he just going like door to door?
Well, I think at the time we were one of the two or three largest affiliates in the space. Not myself, but a group of us that kind of collaborated and gotten together and kind of made a name for ourselves. So, we were making a lot of noise at the conference and running around and touting our skills and ability. And we never saw him at the booth, but you know, somehow, just like so many people email you a spam every day, somehow they get their email address. This guy got our room number, and it was a good match. And we never ended up using the guy for manufacturing. Kind of lost contact with him, but he definitely introduced us to the category and is eventually why we got into the business.
That's pretty awesome. And then I know you're American like me, right? So you went to the UK. So you said that, yeah, because it was kind of coming in the US, so you saw opportunity maybe in the UK. Maybe did anybody in your team have experience there or local?
We had done a bit of marketing, so we kind of expanded the targets or the demographic and geographic targets of our affiliate campaigns to Europe. And UK is certainly the easiest to go in as an American because it's all English and a lot of the same marketing tactics work. So we just looked at the UK as kind of a launch pad for Europe, and we had some advertising contacts there. But more than that, we looked at what e-cigarettes were and why they worked. And when you look at the UK and why e-cigarettes sell as a whole, the UK is a prime market. You have a fairly health conscious group of people. You have extremely expensive cigarettes. You have cold weather, so everyone wants to smoke indoors, but they can't because they have the smoking ban. So there's a lot of reasons that the e-cigarettes sell very well in the UK. And of course, it was English, so it was an easy market for us to go in and penetrate.
Yeah, that's really smart. And I think hopefully listeners are picking up on your, like, you know, the way you're thinking about your market, right? You're analyzing the market even before you entered, right? You had already had this idea, right? You weren't just kind of like randomly like feeling around. You were targeting where you thought was the right place to go. So that's a really, really good thing. And so also, like, so then we're talking about online business. Was this purely distributed online, or was it retail, or maybe?
Yeah, we started online. That's all we knew. You know, we were basically affiliate marketers at the time, and we'd done other online businesses, but we really knew how to market online. And this ended up being one of the great advantages and great strengths of our business and one of the end reasons that we were successful was because we started from an online base where we could run a very profitable, cash flow efficient business, where a lot of the other people that came into the market were distributors, or they're traders. They had some type of retail distribution that they were plugging product into. So that takes a lot more cash, and it the margins are not as good as well. So the entire time we were building strength of our brand online and on the internet, where when we got into the UK market, there was almost no competition. So we spent the first 6 months just building up brand, spent a lot of money on SEO, spent a lot of tension with affiliates. So we were just covering the web. And anytime you Googled e-cigarettes in the UK, we were number one, and we remain that way even to today. And so we were able to build a brand. Now, distribution-wise and sales-wise, other companies were growing faster than us, because you can imagine if you have retail distribution to 5,000 stores in the UK and you can plug them in right away, well, all of a sudden people are going to stores and they're starting to see your brand, and that's huge. Whereas no one was really going online at the time and looking for e-cigarettes. So here we are running a nice, efficient online business, but no one's really seeing it. No one's really seeing that brand, where the distributors that had, you know, had retail spots in five different stores, everyone's getting used to seeing their brand. So they're building a huge presence for the actual category. But then when people go on and see these brands online, and then what is this? What is this? Is it an e-cigarette? Let me go home and research it. And boom, there we were. So we always said, we'll let everyone else build the category and build the presence, and we'll build the brand. And that's really what we did for the first first 2 years until we kind of tapped out the online volume that we thought we could achieve with kind of traditional marketing tactics that we had. And then at that point, we decided it was time to go retail.
Awesome. And maybe, yeah, I have no clue how to do retail. Honestly, I'm more like an online guy. And I think maybe a lot of listeners are too. But what was, so then, but you, I guess you already had the cash flow at that time from your online business to then invest into retail?
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. And I mean, it's going retail is an absolute beast. It takes people that are much smarter than me and a lot smarter than most businesses have. There's so many considerations, obstacles, liabilities that knowing that, you know, when you decide to go into retail, when we decide to go into retail, we had no idea what we were really getting into, which is the reason we went into retail, because if you turn around and say, wow, if you had to go through all that again, would we have done it? It's a tough question to answer. But one of the things that we had advantage of is as Americans, which America being the biggest e-cigarette market in the world at the time and still is we were paying attention to a lot of what was going on there. And we were, again, kind of watching businesses there grow. And we realized that all their growth was in retail. So yeah, they were running nice businesses online. But as soon as businesses really started getting retail foothold, they were just exploding. Their volumes were exploding. So we knew we had to do it. We just didn't know how. And, you know, it's a very challenging thing. Like I said before, there's your cash flows. You have to buy product from a supplier in advance. You land it. Then you have to give it to retailers on 60-day credit terms versus an online business. You buy it. You ship it air freight. You sell it the next day. It processes in 4 days. Money's in the bank, right?
Exactly.
So, and then, you know, to get it into these retail, you know, into these retail locations, it wasn't like turning a switch and saying, okay, we're in 10,000 stores. It was, okay, we got to do this from the ground up. We have to go out and hire sales forces and knock on doors and get in stores one by one by one. Because if you're going to get into the major multiples like Tesco and you know, in the UK, it's Booker's Cash and Carry, which is similar to Costco in the US. They take so much margin. They want product for less than you can make it from your manufacturer. So, you know, for a product like ours, we were trying to establish ourselves as a premium brand and more of a high-end product. We couldn't afford to get in those stores. We would have been taking, you know, a loss on all the sales. So we had to get into the independent stores, which took sales teams. And so to your point, yeah, we had the cash flow at that time from the online business. So we were literally just rolling over all of our profits every single month into retail just to build that retail foothold. And it's a massive, massive operation. And uniting the two online and offline businesses is also a big struggle. But in the end, that is your infrastructure. Online is a brand and you can run efficient business. But when you can get into 10 or 20,000 stores, you have a big business with infrastructure and network. And I think ultimately our decision to go into retail is one of the reasons that we were able to exit at a good time.
Awesome. Great. So now, well, let's hop onto the other side of the world. Let's go into China a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so had you previous experience or your advantages of being on the China, what was your presence in China at the time or experience with China?
Yeah, sure. So right after I went to the UK to kind of start setting up the front side of the business and the brand in the UK, we started, of course, having a lot of problems with the product. And this was our first stab at a product business. So we were essentially just licensing technology and product that was already established in the market. But we didn't understand the product. We didn't really know how it was made or how it was tooled. We didn't know how it could be improved. And everything was being innovated in China. These were Chinese manufacturers that were creating the product and putting it on Alibaba and putting it for sale. And we were just putting a really nice brand on it. So we decided that I would go spend a couple weeks and deal with, you know, looking at the suppliers. I'd never been to China before. I flew into Hong Kong, took the MRT over to China, and you know, not speaking any English, kind of made my way to a manufacturer. We were too small at the time that they wouldn't even pick us up. And the great story of what happened was on my second visit there, just kind of fishing around for different suppliers, I got super sick. Super sick, the sickest I've ever been in my life. No one knows, you know, like it was only like a 48 hour thing, but it was really, really bad. And I didn't know who to call because all the manufacturers were deep in Shenzhen. They weren't like right on the border. They were, you know, out in Shenzhen town, or a couple hour drive. And almost no one at the factory spoke any English, but there was one guy that spoke English, and I kind of talked to him briefly, and he gave me his number. And so I didn't know who to call. I'm at the hospital, of course, call my parents. I'm like, I'm deathly ill in the middle of China, and I don't know what to do. And so I call this guy. I'm like, look, I don't know what to do, but I'm really, really sick. So he comes and picks me up, takes me to the emergency room. The emergency room is short-staffed. They put an IV in me, and he literally sits there while they don't even have a room for me. And I'm in the waiting hall, laying down across benches. And he literally sits there and holds the IV liquids over me for the next 12 hours. Whoa. And so as I start to recover, I start to like talk to this guy just on a personal level. And we're going over, you know, our visions for the business. And somehow he gets this table mat, like a traditional, you know, dinner table mat. He puts on my chest. And he goes, you see this representing the entire table, man. This is the tobacco industry, right? And look at this little thread coming off the corner of it. That's the e-cigarette industry. And then he kind of gestured with his hand and said, but all of this kind of made a gesture towards 50% of the mat. This could all be the e-cigarette industry. And this was when e-cigarettes were really still very small. And I thought, wow, how impressive and intuitive for this Chinese engineer to come up with this vision. And so we started talking about ideas and my ideas and his ideas and how we can improve the product and innovate on the next level and really make them mainstream. And it was just like a light switch went off. Like me and this guy, we happened to be the exact same age. It was like, we're brothers from a different world. And we said at that point, I'm like, look, we're going to have the volume in 6 months. We don't have it now, but I know what we're doing. And we need someone who can, you know, wants to innovate and wants to change things and make this mainstream with us. And he said, well, you know, if you have that much confidence and you have that much confidence in me, we can try to do, you know, a joint venture together. So that was kind of the start of our really boots on the ground relationship in China and what eventually turned into a joint venture and a tremendous relationship. And one of the key advantages, again, of us being successful.
That's a pretty amazing story there. We always have these stories, right, coming into China and how we meet these manufacturers. But that's one I'm gonna always remember here. So it's a joint venture, and maybe you can expand on that. Did that help you in Europe with your branding and your growth?
Tremendously. I mean, I honestly cannot imagine of doing the business, and even stepping back now, being outside the business for a while and having dealt with manufacturing and product development even more. I mean, there's just no way that I feel we could have won in the business without that relationship. And a lot of that is attributed to being flexible and coming over and spending time and, you know, building a relationship with any supplier, but going to China and spending months on end with a partner there. And it was a supplier, but it became our business partner. And, just growing that relationship. I mean, the benefits of doing that were just, you can't even count them. Setting up our own manufacturing facility that no one could visit versus where I could walk into any other manufacturing facility of any of our competitors and watch exactly what they're doing, see their volumes, see their product development, see their new design, see their packaging, you know, everything. All their secrets are away because they've never gone there and built that relationship. And we did. And so, you know, for that reason, there's, of course, the exclusivity. There's the privacy of everything you're doing from design and packaging to all your volumes. You're going to, of course, have a cost benefit there because, you know, with that relationship and that trusted relationship that our partner on the manufacturing side, he just wants to see our volumes go up. So there's, of course, a cost balance there. And then the quality, like the quality just went through the roof because you have that relationship and now all of a sudden they care and you're in this joint venture together. And the bigger that the brand grows in the UK, the bigger the joint venture is going to grow and the more it's going to support and benefit all the parties involved in it. So, you know, I ended up going over and spending months and months on end and I loved it. It was great working with the team there. And we ended up having 500 employees in Shenzhen at the factory and we built an awesome, awesome facility, you know, with game rooms and lunch halls. And it was a really special time. And the benefits to the business, you know, like I said, they just can't be counted.
That's really, really cool. So I don't know if you're allowed to disclose, but how did you bring it? Was this structured in China or was this structured overseas or on the corporate structure?
Sure. It was structured in China. We used a group of Chinese attorneys, and it was quite complicated to set it up for sure, but we got the appropriate legal help that both parties agreed on. And it took, it took about 5 to 6 months to actually set up. And there's a lot of rules and challenges in doing so, but you know, we were never in it for the money. We were in it for all the intangible benefits and having that relationship there and making sure that our product quality was good and that everything that we were doing was going to be secret, because I had spent enough time over there to know that, you know, really anyone could go over there and get trade secrets.
Yeah, it's true.
So,
yeah.
You know, this was because we were trying to be a full scale business instead of just someone that's just sprinkling kind of unbranded product around. We just had to have that stuff secure and all the designs and packaging. We had to have that stuff secure. So we really did it for the intangible benefits. We actually never made much money off it, if anything, but having what you could call your own facility there and walking to a facility that was branded SkySig and everyone was wearing SkySig shirts it makes the whole business just feel so much more well-rounded. And it was a much more full-scale business at that point.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And I always kind of almost chuckle when sometimes I just randomly go to a factory. And like you said, like I can see like the even big brands, like in the West, I can see their assembly, their packaging. Like I could almost probably, if I really wanted to, I could just ask to see their numbers. Like it really is amazing, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, credit to anyone who's going and spending time in China, because there's just so many people that don't. They want to stay over in, you know, the cozy office and not go out and figure it out and build those relationships. So it's something that is absolutely necessary, I think, for startups and really businesses of all sizes to go over and meet and build those relationships. And the benefits that you'll get from doing so and spending time there are invaluable.
Cool. I totally agree. And I hope more do take our advice and get over here. So let's move on to the exit. Did you have this end? Did you begin with the end in mind? Sometimes these books say to have your exit prepared before you even start. Maybe you can discuss maybe your thought at the start and your exit strategy.
Sure. So when we started the business, it was not, we're going to get acquired by a tobacco company. This is a great opportunity. It kind of falls in line with what we're doing already. And it's something that we can probably scale. And with affiliate marketing, I mean, I must say it is one of the greatest businesses in the entire world. I mean, anyone who's done a consumer product business and done affiliate marketing, they always want to look at affiliate marketing and go, God, things were so easy. Why don't I just keep doing that? Because you have ad spend here and you have revenue here. The consumer product business is just a beast. So when we got into it, we really didn't know that, you know, what's an exit, right? We had sold businesses before, but they weren't a 9-10 figure range of any sort. So we just wanted to build a great operation that supported a more international lifestyle. And we didn't really know what we were getting into until the wheel started clicking. And once we started putting up volumes similar to what we were doing on the affiliate side of things, but now we actually owned the business and we owned the brand and we had a face to what we were doing. So at that point, we kind of looked at what was going on in the industry and said, wow, this is not a gimmick of a product. This is something that has the ability to completely disrupt and revolutionize tobacco. And at that point is when we really sat down and said, let's put together a strategy on where to take this. And it was never, should we do an IPO or let's get acquired by a certain category. It was, let's build this as big as we can. And then we'll worry about how to make money off it at the end.
Awesome. And maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, profit taking versus reinvesting earnings. Like, did that change in the middle or maybe you can just talk about your plans for profit taking and growth.
Absolutely. It's a very challenging topic and strategy when you have mixed partners that are in different, I would say, emotional levels, but also different. That also goes with financial levels. So you had me, who was kind of this young buck, you know, for the majority of the business, I was 25, 26, 27 years old. I had money, but I was really excited about this business and the profits that we were making each month. and then other people involved in the business that could care less about taking any type of profits a month. They were in it for how big can we build this and how big of an exit can we make. So we had this really lean, mean e-cigarette machine that was rolling and spitting off profits each month. So, you know, there are certain people on the team that say, let's take this. You know, this is great. We don't know where this business is going to go. You have all types of potential government issues, litigation. You don't know how long this wave's going to roll. So let's take profits now. And then you have others who say, no, this isn't a business that you're going to sit back and take a dividend each month. This is a business that we're going to reinvest the earnings and the growth. And so that was a really challenging part because, you know, for me, I hadn't been in a business that had grown to such scale in the past. So it's good to have those experience and to have advisors that really know what to do at certain points and can analyze the industry you're in and the growth that you're in, because these are all questions that, especially me, when we're going through our what I would consider hyper growth, I didn't know the answers to that. And luckily there was people there to say, this is a business you can't be worried about taking profit from. You need to reinvest this in the growth and do it big, and good things will come in the end that are much more financially beneficial than what you could take a month now. So very early on, we started reinvesting all of the profits in the growth, and that eventually became almost all retail and office and employee expansion, to a point we got to about 50 or 60 employees, two offices in the UK. The joint venture, of course, took money to set up and resources. So, you know, we had a very large business, and it could only have been possible by reinvesting and not taking.
I totally agree. I'm more on your side with reinvesting. And I think a lot of us have had, you know, partners that, like you mentioned a little bit, with different goals or risk tolerances. And I've had my share too in the past with that. Maybe you were talking about partners a little bit. I know that that's always tricky, and you can maybe share as much as you're comfortable with, like, you know, advice or mindset on equity partners in a startup.
Mm-hmm. My view is always that it depends on what you want to do with a business. If you're setting up more of this kind of digital entrepreneur and something that's much more lifestyle bound, then it's one way. If you're sitting there and saying, all I care about is building a huge business and doing this right, then of course your mindset's a different way. So, you know, since I was 25, my drive was always, I want to do something really, really big. I don't need to float around and live in a beach house and support, you know, a minimum lifestyle. I just want to build a big business, something that's meaningful, something that is good for society, something that has a face and you can build a reputation around. So with that mindset, you have to bring on the right people at the right time. And you can't always bring on people for money. I go through it even with all my new businesses. The best people are not going to take, you know, a $10,000 a month salary or even more. They want equity. They want to be part of something. They want to build something with you and with a team. And so to do that, you have to give up equity. And there's all different types of ways to structure it. And of course, there's risks, and there's a lot of partnerships that don't work out. There's many more partnerships that don't work out than do work out. And there's the majority of businesses that fail because of partnerships, not because of lack of opportunity. So you have to be very careful in who you bring on. You need to vet those people well and understand where they are emotionally in their lives and see how it all is to jive together. But I'm a big proponent of giving up equity to bring the right people in. And if your goal is really to build business, like a nine-figure business or an eight-figure, a nine-figure, even 10-figure business, it doesn't really matter if you end up owning 5% or 10% or 20%. If you own 5% of a billion-dollar company, you're still super rich and not going to know what to do with all the money. It's just a matter of getting there. And by getting there, you have to bring in the right people at the right time. So I think for anyone out there that wants to build something meaningful, they need to put in the time to find the right partners, the right advisors. And to get those right people, you're going to have to incentivize them with equity.
Yeah, I do agree there. And this kind of leads into the next question is, you know, it was a great exit on SkySig, and maybe I'm sure the team is probably one of your answers, but maybe you can talk about some of the major factors that you think contributed to that success.
Yeah, sure. I think one being that we were very flexible, and because of my position being, I was 25 at the time when we started, I was extremely hungry and flexible. So for the entire lifespan of the business, over the next 3.5 years, I never slept in the same bed more than 5 days in a row. I was literally bouncing all over the UK, China and back almost every 2-3 weeks, all over Europe. And then, of course, I wanted to get home and see my parents in the US. But that, having that flexibility where you don't have to send someone to go do a job for you, you intimately knowing the procedures of the business, can get on a plane or a bus or a train or wherever and be wherever the business needs you at that time, was extremely valuable. The joint venture and the relationships in China were invaluable to the business and one of the key successes. And I think really have us understanding online businesses and affiliate marketing allowed us to get in, and we really created a profitable business in about 4 months. That's from sourcing product, building a website, putting it online, and starting to sell goods. Immediately had a profitable business. And we only could do that because of our skill set as internet marketers. And that got us through the next 12 to 15 months of building up cash flows and cash reserves that we could then scale the office, scale employees, and start rolling some profits into retail. If we had started as retail first, we never would have had the cash or the branding or the network and consumer base to have grown as quickly as we did and with the cash that we had.
Awesome. Yeah, it's definitely some great advice here. And maybe we can give a little bit of story about, so you work with investment bankers on your exit. Maybe you can give a little bit of how that worked and how it supported
The deal. Around the time that we were starting to make decisions of how to grow to the next level, this is when retail started to take a little bit of a foothold, and a lot of changes were going on in the industry. There was a lot of competitors that were starting to raise money. Tobacco was starting to take a moderate interest in the industry, and we didn't really know, you know, how to continue to grow as we had on our own money, as we were privately funded. And so we started just looking around for different options. One of the options being, well, let's raise private equity and we'll scale into new countries and grow retail at a much faster rate. And the other one was, well, maybe this is a good time to exit. And that was, of course, always in the back of your mind as an entrepreneur and you're building a business. You think, well, you know, maybe it's a good time to exit, but how does an exit even come by? And you turn on Yahoo News or anything and you see so-and-so was acquired for X. And you're like, how did that happen? Like, did Google just go knock on their door and say, hey, we want to buy you? Did they email customer service and say, hey, we're inquiring about buying your business? Like, I never knew how businesses were really sold, at least like tech startups. So we ended up having a contact at an investment bank in London. We had a conversation with them and they're super down to earth guys like us. They weren't big corporate type of advisors. They're very, just friendly and like down to earth. They understood the business. They actually used our product and we just said, you know what, let's engage with these guys and see what they can do. And around that time we started having interest from different players in the category. And so what happened was they just ended up putting together a process that, you know, said, here's where the business is. If you have interest, we need a term sheet. And one thing led to another, and so became the exit of SkySig.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sam, for sharing all this with us. And so it's been great, and there's been some time now. What have you been up to? What's your new venture?
Sure. So I took a few months. I mean, the exit was long and daunting, and it took all of about a year to really wind down and dot all the I's and cross the T's and kind of start over. And what I've been into since of I've become a partner, or actually I found co-founded and partner in a business called SmartMat, which is the first interactive yoga mat. And that's been a long, very aggressive road that from basically concept to product development. We just had a Indiegogo crowdfunding launch last October. And we went to CES in Las Vegas just a couple weeks ago and had a tremendous response and success. Actually, VentureBeat had us as the standout product at CES. So tremendous honor and just another, you know, right back into the spin of things. But, you know, it's just great to do business, and especially on an international level, and collaborate with like-minded people. So I think once it's in your blood, like, it's never not this point now, it's not about the exit. It's about just building cool things and working with great teams. And I hope I have that for a very long time.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. Yeah, you're definitely, it's true. It's totally addicting. And I've also been seeing the news about SmartMatt, and I'm really excited for you guys. So that's great. And if anybody wants to maybe reach out, how should they go about contacting you or checking out your business?
Sure. I mean, anyone can reach me at my business email for SmartMatt, which is that's the easiest one to give out anyways, is sam@smartmatt.com. I answer 100% of my emails every single day. At some point that might be unsustainable, but for now that's the routine. So I would love to engage and interact or answer any questions that any of the listeners have.
Great. Okay. And that's a wrap. Thanks so much, Sam. Thanks, Sam, for sharing, and I'm sure listeners got some inspiration ideas for taking their businesses to the next level. I've been lucky enough to hang out with Sam a few times since recording, and he's coming down to Hong Kong to relocate in the coming months, so I'm excited to see him more and hopefully get him on the show. Don't forget to check out the quick Hong Kong company checklist I put together at globalfromasia.com/HK checklist. And as always, please let me know any show topics, questions, concerns, or anything you have for future episodes. Enjoy the rest of your week, and may the force be with you as you build your international business. Peace.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.